Hello, and welcome to episode 62 of the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast. From Torquay to the top of the world. 1988 had seen Zvezda foiled in the fog. 1989 had seen Zvezda be casual in Kern. 1990-1991, however, was to be very, very different. But it would start in a bit of a weird place. 10 months before the biggest game in Sven Zvezda's history, they would be in transit to Scarborough after a friendly draw against the Giants of Merthyr Tydfil. They would start the season at another bit of the British coastline. In fact, much of the prep time ahead of the 1990-91 season had, in fact, been spent trying to pull together some decent English clubs for them to play glamour friendlies against. Spurned by the likes of Liverpool and Arsenal, a pre-season tour was arranged of 6 games incorporating Torquay, Hinckley, Crewe Alexandra, Merthyr Tydfil, Scarborough and Bradford. 2 third-tier sides, 2 fourth-tier ones and 2 non-league ones. In an era where we have the concept of the International Champions Cup, where the biggest sides in the world go to the four corners of the world in front of packed stands to play exhibitions for big money, or at least they did prior to COVID, it is surprising to hear that a side who were rightly one of the favourites to win a European trophy would start by playing English non-entities. But that's exactly what they did. It began in Torquay, then, starting with a 2-1 win with the goal scored by Rosneci, Mitar Mokela, who had moved to Twente mid-season, and the former Sheffield Wednesday and Newport veteran, Tommy Tynan. It proved to be a start to memorable seasons for both sides. Torquay would, as everyone knows, go on to get promotion to the third tier by beating Blackpool on penalties in the playoff final. Sven Zvezda, well, what did they ever do? Hinckley would fall 9-1. Crewe, for whom the whole game is filmed and on YouTube, featuring an absolutely fabulous Prosnecci free kick, were felled 4-0. Merthyr obtained a 1-1 draw. Panchev doubled as Scarborough were down 4-2 before the Tour of England was over with a glamour tie against Bradford City, a 2-1 defeat. Perhaps there's no European champion that's ever started their season in less auspicious surrounds than touring from Plainmoor to Valley Parade, but then again, this was no ordinary side. This was a truly great one. As much as we've discussed in previous episodes, how the generation of Yugoslavia at the national team level are fondly remembered for what they could have done, because of the sheer volume of talent that came out of the region and starred in the 1990s, as well as that won the World Youth Championship in 87, this Zvezda side, perhaps, is the one that actually shows us the closest glimpse of what actually could have been. This was the product of years of planning and putting pieces together to create a great side, of backing youth, of building slowly, and, crucially, of learning their lessons year on year. This was also the last time any side from the east of Europe ever really could challenge for the top honour in European football before the advent of the Champions League changed football forever. If Italia 90 represented the death of the football of the past, this European Cup would represent the death of another era. The final season without English representation, as Liverpool, who would have taken part in it, had their ban last a year longer than the other English sides, and also would be the final season of proper knockout football before the advent of group stages in the following season. So, with the scene set, it's time to introduce our cast. The natural place to begin with is Ljupko Petrović. Petrović, of course, landed on his feet, picking up a talented generation at Vojvodina and promptly winning the title with them. His introduction to Zvezda was important for 2 players. Sinisa Mihajlović, who brought in from Vojvodina, and Vladimir Jugovic, who he'd had on loan at Rad, and who Petrovic immediately thrust into the midfield at Zvezda. Tactically, Petrovic had, I should say has, he's still going, three key elements. Counter-attacking, a hard press in the midfield specifically, and defensive flexibility. All of which would be exemplified at different points of Zvezda's European Cup campaign, and all of which would be overshadowed a bit by the non-event that was the final that gave this Zvezda side the impression of a dull side to many, but they were anything but. Save for a substitute appearance for Montenegrin Zeljko Kalajerovic, Stevan Stojanovic would be in goals for every European game of the season. Stojanovic had come through the youth system and had been the main goalkeeper for a couple of seasons at this point. He had been spared the mental hurt of the Kern tie the prior season in favour of some physical hurt, having broken his arm in training in the run-up to the second leg. With Pixie having gone west to Marseille, more on them later, Stojanovic took over as club captain. Covered in depth a couple of episodes ago was Romanian Serb Miodrag Beladidici, seen by Sheki as the final piece of the defensive puzzle at the club. Alongside him would be Dusko Radinovic, an ex-Ceska player who would play in every game except the final. Ilya Najdorski, part of Vardar's league winners, who would go on to play in Macedonia's first ever international. Former Osijek player Slobodan Marović, who had been in the same youth team as Stefan Stojanovic and played under Petrovic at Osijek. Refik Sabanadzevic, who we heard a bit about last episode, had been part of Ivica Osim's Zelyesnikar side and then was sent off in the 1990 World Cup quarter-final, which would also turn out to be his last cap. He had done well to recover from injury, having been comatose after a header on his return to Krbovice in 1987 after joining Zvezda. It saw a straight elbow give him a head injury that left him in hospital for over a month and out of football for over six. Having qualified from medical school as his fallback if football hadn't worked out, Zvezda was so convinced that Sabanadzevic's career was over, they actually paid him his full contract in advance on the assumption he was done. Bit part defensive roles would be played by Tuzla and Hajduk alumnus Raditosic, Goran Juric, who left for Celta Vigo mid-season, and former Radniki Niš defender Goran Vasiljevic. In midfield, three players would play every game of Zvezda's run. Vlada Stosic began in the youth setup of Dinamo Vranje, Serbia's most banter club, before moving to Zvezda at 19 and bouncing around on loan for a few years until breaking into the side in 1989 and staying there. And believe me, if you've never heard of Vlada Stosic, if you go back and watch these games, you will be astonished by just how good he is. Vladimir Jugovic, however, needs no introduction. A true Zvezda youth product, having started there at 15, his starring turn at Rad the season prior, 7 goals and 16, so Petrovic places confidence in him to take a place in the midfield for Zvezda. By the end of the 90s, he was rightly regarded as one of the best midfielders of his generation as part of the Champions League winning midfield at Juventus and scoring the winning penalty in that 1996 final. The other ever-present midfielder needs no introduction either, Robert Prosinecki. Prosinecki had made an impact at Zvezda almost as soon as he joined, much to the chagrin of Ćiro Blažević, who had so confidently stated he'd amount to nothing, and he'd actually proven a bit of an iron man at Zvezda, a reputation that would be torn to shreds as soon as he left the club. Over the competition, it would perhaps be his peak. His one main move, dragging the ball back, was predictable, but impossible to defend against, a bit like Arjen Robben cutting inside, and his vertical movement was impossible for many to follow. And there are, of course, two players who weren't ever present in the midfield that also require next to no introduction. Dejan Savicevic missed his entire first season with the club serving his mandatory national service, but was permitted to play in European games, receiving one-to-one fitness coaching in Skopje during his army stint. This weird arrangement actually ended up having far bigger ramifications. It prompted FA head Miljan Miljanic to lobby the government to create a sporting battalion, allowing footballers to serve and train together. In late 1988, the government granted this, likely in a fit of pique after realising that Savachevich and Panchev were both serving service because the army men behind Partisan had wanted to scupper the hopes of their rivals. Soon, Savachevich, Panchev and many others in the service at the time, including household names like Zvonimir Boban, Fadil Vokri and Alyosha Asanovich, were part of a footballing battalion that became little more than a bit of marching in the mornings before normal football training in the afternoons. Savichevich, along with army mate Panchev, would be voted second in the Ballon d'Or voting for 1991, with Prosinecki just behind them in fourth. The other famed member of the midfield is, of course, Petrovic's pickup from his Vojvodina side, the fluffy-haired Sinisa Mihailovic. Much like Prosinecki, he had been rejected by Dinamo, which, in Mihailovic's case, was due to his haircut. He had stayed back a bit longer at Vosa than Petrovic, even scoring in the European Cup with his hand, and quickly developed a reputation as, bluntly, a bit of a mean bastard, as we'll get to in the next episode when talking about the 1991 Cup final. But would also suffer more than many others in the wars to come, with his childhood home in Borovo-Nashelje being destroyed by his former best friend and his father killed. Mihailovic is from Bosnian Serb and Croat parents. Borovo-Nashelje is part of the Vukovar campaigns and was one of the first places bombed, with the first attacks, as we mentioned, coming between the two legs of the semi-final. Finally, for the midfield, was Ivica Momcilovic, formerly of Napredak, who made one appearance in the tournament. Up front, only two strikers played, with both ever-present, Darko Panchev and Dragisin Binic. Panchev would win the Golden Boot this season, retrospectively, because there was some nonsense in Cyprus that made those running it make it unofficial for a while, and had more or less started scoring bucketfuls of goals as soon as he put football boots on. This would be the seventh season in a row in which he would score more than 10 goals domestically, despite having been at Vardar for much of that time, who were, of course, weaker than Zvezda. By this time, such scoring had already seen the Cobra recognised as one of football's deadliest strikers. This would be the first season he would really prove it in continental football. By the time Dragisa Binic joined Zvezda in 1990, he was already a bit of a journeyman. He had started at Napredak before moving to Rudniki Nice and having a short spell in 87 at Zvezda. However, he fell out massively with then-coach Velibor Vasevic, eventually ending up with Binic turning up at Vasevic's house and offering him a square go. He was swiftly sent to Brest in France, where he excelled for a season, before a quieter season at Levante, followed by a return to Zvezda. In doing so, he became only the second player, after none other than Dragan Zajec himself, to return to Zvezda after a spell abroad. It seems startling in retrospect that this team is one of the more forgotten European Cup winners, victims to the circumstance of the chaos in the nation that led into the season and that would immediately follow it, and victims to a time that sat them squarely at the end of an era that many in the West, particularly the Anglophone world, would prefer to forget. A side that gets unfairly cast aside as part of an era that was cast aside in itself in favour of the money-spinning revolution of the 1990s. It's also a side that crossed almost all national divides in the nation. Only Slovenia of the main republics didn't have a representative within this Zvezda side. The road to Bari would, having begun in Torquay, start proper in Belgrade with a first round tie against Grasshoppers Zurich. Grasshoppers were, at this point, in the midst of a bit of a golden era, in the second season of what would prove to be three title-winning seasons in a row managed by the legendary Ottmar Hitzfeld. And, having reached the quarterfinals of the Cup Winners' Cup the season prior, they were a very challenging first-round draw, and so it proved at a near-full Maracanã, as Grasshoppers took the lead on the quarter hour through a free kick moved to the right by for Peter Kurzer to blast home from 20 yards. They would keep the pressure on for much of the first half through set pieces and counters, before Dragisa Binic equalised just before half-time, as Zvezda capitalised on the Swiss side falling asleep on a quick throw-in. Zvezda remained on top for much of the rest of the game, with the Swiss unable to deal with Prosinecki's drifting and passing. But it remained 1-1, and very much alive going into the second leg in Zurich. Panchev would start the fun there early, poking home from an undefendable lofted through ball from Stosic on 11 minutes. The lead would be doubled from the spot by Prosinecki after Panchev was body checked in the box on 49 minutes, sending the keeper the wrong way, and killing the tie with Radinovic adding to the total 10 minutes later after a Panchev shot was deflected into his path to allow him to drive a low shot home from the edge of the box. Peter Kurzel, that man again, would have a chance to score Grasshopper's own penalty soon after following a foul in the box in the midst of a scramble. His spot kick would be saved by Stojanovic, but fall back into his path to claw the Swiss side back into the realms of hope. Panchev would draw another penalty in the last 10 minutes, dragged down in the box, and Prosinecki went to the opposite corner with his penalty again to kill any Swiss hopes of a revival. Their second round tie would be against Glasgow Rangers. The famous story of the tie, which I'm sure you all already know as it goes, is that Graeme Souness sent his assistant Walter Smith to go and watch Zvezda live. Smith duly did, taking in a cup tie against Proletaire Zrenjanin. When asked on his return by Souness what his scouting report of Zvezda was, it was simply two words. We're effed. While that probably wouldn't pass for much of an opposition analysis nowadays, it's fair to say that Rangers were at this time a very impressive outfit, having benefited from a transfer policy of essentially giving other clubs money like it was candy and bringing in English players who wanted to play in Europe but couldn't because of the ban following Heysel. As a result, the side contained England internationals in Gary Stevens, Chris Woods and Trevor Stephen, and no small amount of Scotland ones with the likes of Richard Gough and Ali McCoist. This was a side which, let's be quite honest, had stated aspirations to win the European Cup and had confirmed them with a one-sided spanking of Valletta in the first round, which saw Mo Johnson score five times across the two legs. But Smith's brusque assessment would be proven right, and very quickly so, at the Maracanã, with Bomber Brown diverting a Radinovic cross into his own net on 8 minutes after a move set up by an incredible Prosinecki diagonal through ball. They would survive the rest of the first half before Prosinecki would catch Woods out from a free kick just after the hour, sweeping a ball in at the near post with the keeper set for a cross to the far. Panchev would end things, breaking away from his marker and slotting home across at the near post to give Zvezda a convincing 3-0 lead to take to Glasgow. And 3-0 was kind on Rangers. They had been utterly outclassed for 90 minutes, and had 3-0 been the half-time score, it would not have been an unfair reflection of Zvezda's dominance. In front of a not even half-full Ibrox, presumably because the local fans knew they had no chance, Zvezda finished the job, taking the lead on the night through some Panchev acrobatics following a Prosinecki cross. McCoist would pull one back to make it a draw on the night, but the tie was long dead before the sides even reached Glasgow. Zvezda's reward was a quarter-final tie against the East German champions Dynamo Dresden. Were this the history of East German football? By the way, no, I'm not going to start doing a podcast on that. Then this would also be a landmark season, the final season of the East German top tier, the Oberliga, before sides moved into a United Bundesliga and the Oberliga turned into a regional Liga tier the following season. Dynamo Dresden had beaten Union Luxembourg and Malmo to reach the quarters, but were a weakened outfit. On the day of the second leg of their first round tie, Germany reunited. Dresden were already playing as champions of a nation that no longer existed, a nation whose inevitable march out of existence had begun a year earlier with the fall of the Berlin Wall. The most immediate result for Dynamo was that they saw young players head for the West in the summer of 1990. East Germany's Footballer of the Year, the 24-year-old Ulf Kirsten, left for Leverkusen, where he would remain until he retired, and the 23-year-old Matthias Sammer, who would captain East Germany on their final international, went to Stuttgart. They were merely the most high profile of those departing, with there having been an unsurprising exodus. Perhaps the most known of those that remained would be Torsten Gutscher, the final East German player of the year, who had a formidable scoring record in Europe. With Dresden a weaker side than Rangers on paper, it was little surprise that Zvezda East passed them in the first leg with another 3-0 win. It would open with a magnificent 25-yard free kick from Prosinecki into the top corner on 22 minutes, with Binic finishing from close range at the end of the half before Savicevic added the exclamation point early in the second half with a low drive from outside the box across the keeper to make it 3-0. Much like against Rangers, it could have been more. Unlike against Rangers, the second leg would be very memorable in its own right. For one, Dresden would take the lead, and quickly. Gutschau scoring from the spot in the third minute after a handball was given in a melee in the box, albeit his penalty only just dribbled past Stevanovic, who got a hand to it. Soon, however, Zvezda took control and could easily have brought things back before half-time. Instead, it took until the 52nd minute for them to bring Dresden back to level terms on the night, as Savicevic pulled out an incredible goal, dancing through three strong challenges before firing in from just inside the box. Panchev would take Zvezda into the lead on the night a quarter of an hour later. By this point, however, there began to be clashes between Dynamo fans and police at the front of the stands. Soon after, a cross would be blocked, giving Zvezda a corner in the area of the stadium that clashes had begun at. By this point, police had abandoned it and left it to the fans. And as Prosinecki went to take the corner, he found himself and the linesman having to turn and flee under a hail of debris. The match was paused while police stepped around to regain control and the debris was moved. But as soon as the linesman went back over, the barrage began again. Dresden players went over to speak to the crowd to get them to go back and allow the game to continue. And another attempt at carrying on was tried, with fans now chucking stuff at their own players as soon as anyone went near the corner. By the time the police brought out the water cannon, the game had already been abandoned, and Zvezda would be awarded a 3-0 win on the night to give them, officially, a 6-0 aggregate win, as opposed to the 5-1 win they were already carrying. Theirs would not be the only quarterfinal to be called a bit early. Marseille-Milan ended in farcical circumstances. After a floodlight failure in second half injury time, with Marseille 2-1 up on aggregate, saw their opponents, AC Milan, just refused to come back out. Marseille would get that one given 3-0 to them too, with Milan banned from Europe for a season. Milan were, of course, the holders under Arrigo Sacchi, and in the middle of a golden generation of a side. But Marseille had knocked them out, and let's be honest, they would have even if the lights had stayed on, wasn't a massive shock, and was that side's ascendance from being a side that could hang at this level, to a side for whom immortality seemed only a heartbeat away. Zvezda's reward was a return to Germany, this time to the West, in the semi-final, and a tie against the might of Bayern Munich. This is the tie ultimately people remember most about Zvezda's run in the European Cup, if they're looking to remember it fondly. It was one featured in the Blizzard's Greatest Games podcast, as the second leg of the tie having been one of the greatest games of all time. And, well, this particular Wilson isn't about to disagree with Jonathan Wilson on that one. This podcast has always been about the intersection of football and history, and this tie perhaps fulfills that quota more than any we'll ever cover. Firstly, quite aside from anything, the tie is 180 minutes of pure, exhilarating football that's followed up by a final that was anything but, for understandable reasons. Secondly, as noted at the start of this episode, the first salvos of the war had landed between the two legs with the Plitvice Lakes incident, which we'll go across in the next episode, happening just prior. Belgrade in the second leg had an energy about it of expectation. There was a Serbian national expectation of success on the pitch, but expectation of conflict to come. Add to all that Bayern had their own deal going on, a 15-year wait for a European Cup, which was seen as a travesty by many at the club and something that could be, no, must be, redressed. And the history just seeps through the football at every point. Sometimes you get games which come with the feeling of a grand TV season finale, laden with drama and narrative, and which look in retrospect to have been one of the most important games. It's hard to think that anyone could believe anything other than that this tie fits into that category. And it would be no exaggeration to say that this buy-in generation were pretty good. Reuter, Köhler, Augenthaler, Effenberg, Laudrup, theirs was a side filled with great players. Jupp Heynckes in the dugout knew Zvezda as well and prepped his side well, specifically that Bayern would need to watch out for the counter-attack. Petrovic did similarly. His tactic was simple: bring the Germans forward, press them around the box, and then break in behind the wing-backs to expose the pace of the ageing Augenthaler. The first real chance would come Zvezda's way. Prosinecki sending a dipping free kick cross shot and forcing a smart save to tip it over at the bar. But Bayern, however, opened their account in the first leg at the Olympiastadion, taking the lead on 23 minutes after some neat work around the box set full fart 3 to score an audacious chip. Bayern hadn't conceded at home in the tournament at that point, and it would need something special to break them. Prosinecki tried soon after, breaking past two challenges down the left and shooting low into the keeper before a cross of his would end up being cleared off the line. Effenberg would see a shot tipped wide. Zvezda would have more set-piece challenges, but Bayern just would not be unlocked at the back as yet. What did unlock them was one of the finest goals in the history of football. With the first half drawing to a close, a ball was put through for Brian Laudrup to chase. Marovic intercepted it about 10 yards out at the edge of his box, took a touch and fed it forward to Beladici, who neatly nipped it to Radinovic, who took one touch to move it forward to Prosinecki in face. The distinctive blonde figure of Prosinecki, born in West Germany, turned, took a touch and then slid through a 60-yard through ball to Binic, who was sprinting through down the inside right channel. He took a touch, looked up on the run to see Panchev sprinting at the opposite post, and Binic put in a low diagonal cross that Panchev met and turned in from 5 yards. In the space of 11 seconds, Zvezda had gone from being turned round facing their own goal, back to front, always with purpose, always with control, and had torn enough defence that had in most part just won the World Cup to shreds. In the long list of truly great counter-attacking goals, it's hard to conjure up that many could top this, lightning fast, laced with risk from playing from the back, and, most importantly, at the very, very highest level of football. There was time for kickoff to be taken and no more. Zvezda had counter-attacked and counter-punched Bayern at the perfect time, and sent them sprawling. Bayern would not regain control again, even when having a goal disallowed from a corner for a foul in the box. Come the 70th minute, Bayern would be counted on again. A through ball was blocked and sent in the direction of Panchev. With one touch to Savicevic, Zvezda was suddenly through one-on-one. Savicevic galloped to the edge of the box and slid the ball home. Binic would see a pair of shots into the side netting, and then Zvezda would have a couple of other breaks to come closer to adding to their lead than Bayern did to pegging them back. West Germany, or I suppose as it was at the point then, Germany, so often the graveyard of Sion Zvezda's European dreams, be that Mönchengladbach in 1979, Bayern themselves in 1980, or Köln in 1990, had suddenly become the venue of perhaps their greatest performance, and left them one game away from their first European Cup final. But the job was only half done, and there was a return leg in Belgrade to navigate first. What ensued was one of history's greatest games of football. First blood went to Sven Zvezda. A break from Binic was cynically ended 30 yards out. Zenisa Mihailovic stood over the ball and swerved a low free kick straight into the bottom corner, with the goalkeeper Raymond Aumann not moving an inch. The tie could have been put to bed soon after as Panchev broke, slipped the ball to Radinovic, who chipped across back to the Cobra, but his header was just too weak to trouble too much. Binic would have a chance to try and round off an incredible team move starting from Mihailovic to Savicevic to Radinovic, putting it forward to Panchev, laying off to Jugovic to thread Binic free, who shot into the side netting with a move so good it deserved a goal, and one that would have been the equal of the wonder goal in Bavaria. Savicevic then ripped Bayern's right to shreds before shooting when he should have crossed and slicing the ball well wide. Sviesta had three or four chances to kill Bayern off, as at times they tore the Germans to pieces with the sort of football that would have torn any side apart, particularly in an era where defending was very different to what it is now. They would regret their profligacy. Augenthaler, having been targeted in the first leg as Bayern's big weakness, dragged his side back into the tie on 60 minutes. A free kick laid off to the side for him to hammer, squirming under Stojanovic on a routine low save to make it 1-1 on the night. 5 minutes later, Manfred Bender levelled the tie. A deep cross from the left would be flicked against the Sviesta defender, with Bender happily picking up the deflection, bouncing neatly into his path to poke home. With 25 minutes of the game left, everything was level, and there were 25 minutes for either Sven and Sviesta or Bayern Munich to etch their names in history. Binic would get the first chance. A cross knocked back across goal from Panchev would allow Binic to turn, but his scooped shot went just wide. Bayern then cracked the post from a move begun by Laudrup and almost finished by Wolfart, with the ball deflecting off the post just past Effenberg. Then came history. With the game heading for extra time come the final minute, the pace dropped ever so slightly. At that point, Jugovic struck, driving from midfield with a 1-2 and beating four challenges in the process. The one that did get knocked the ball straight to Prozinecki, who drove into the box, laid the ball back to Mihailovic, taking the space Prozinecki had vacated. He looped a low cross in towards Panchev, but Augenthaler, in space, stuck his leg out first. The ball looped high. It looped elusively. The second stretched into a minute, as Aumann stretched to reach the ball. Instead, it slipped between crossbar and flailing hand into the goal. The Maracanã erupted. The pitch was invaded, with fans taking part of the turf. Although no one knew it at the time, it would be the last European game played at the Maracanã for over 4 years. But the celebrations at the ground were perhaps entirely fitting of such an occasion. Marseille awaited Sviesta, and, importantly, a familiar face awaited Sviesta in Pixie. Stojkovic had arranged his transfer to the French Nouveau Riche prior to Italia 90 and joined a ridiculously talented side. Papin, Cantona, Deschamps, Tigana, and many more, all managed by a certain Franz Beckenbauer, fresh from winning Italia 90 for his first club job. De Keyser wouldn't last the season, moving to more of a sporting director role mid-season after falling out with owner Bernard Tapie over the infrastructure of the club and Beckenbauer's unwillingness to immerse himself in French culture. By that point, Pixie was in Germany, specifically on an operating table having suffered an early season knee injury, the first of a series of injuries that would plague Pixie until 1994 and his move to Japan and his own personal renaissance. Marseille had easily won Ligue 1 that season through the goals of Papin, a league with a couple of other exceptional Yugoslavs in it that season, namely Asanovic, Susic and Vujovic. Marseille's route to the final had, if one takes Milan out of the equation, been somewhat easier than Sviesta's, with easy wins in the opening rounds over Dinamo Tirana and Lech Poznan before a comfortable semi-final win over Spartak Moscow, who had done for Napoli and Real Madrid themselves. Marseille were, understandably, heavy favourites for the final. No side had been funded more handsomely in Europe, after all. Now, it's hard not to get to this particular point and not also mention Marseille's penchant for the dark arts. Specifically, that there are multiple allegations around matches, both proven and unproven, that they fixed games. This particular game, the final, was no exception, with a specific allegation made by Dejan Savicevic that he and other players turned down an offer totalling 500,000 Deutschmark. In addition, similar allegations exist around Marseille's semi-final win over Spartak Moscow that came out in legal papers in the late 90s. Given that Marseille would, 2 years later, stage a fixed match against Valenciennes so as to ensure players were fit and available for the 1993 final, so as to ensure there was no repeat of the couple of injuries that kept players out of the 1991 final, these allegations are all too believable. Whether or not you deem Zavicevic to have provided a reliable account. And as we've mentioned in previous episodes, there are plenty of reasons to assume that Zavicevic may not be the most reliable witness in the world. Marseille's form book would suggest it's likely that some sort of something was at least attempted, but nothing can be stated with certainty. For a start, it would have been reasonably difficult to try to arrange anything with any Zvezda players given that they arrived for the final early, turning up 6 days before the game and entering a lockdown in a training camp in Monopoly. No player, partners or family were allowed in, and phones were removed from the rooms due to the worry that other clubs would try to contact and acquire players while they were in Italy. The club brought an entourage of VIPs that more or less contained every living legend the club had. Shecky, who, after his 8-game ban after the current game of the prior season, could have at least managed the final if he stayed about. Misa Pavic, Rajko Mitic, Dragan Zajac, along with just over 20,000 fans travelling to the game. After the chaos and excitement of the semi-final, the final was eagerly anticipated, and it absolutely sucked. The 1991 European Cup final is renowned as one of the worst editions of all time. Prior to the game, Petrovic and his management staff had gone through tapes of Marseille, and two things stood out. One, they liked to counter-attack like Siesta, and two, they were very relaxed and confident in big game situations. His instructions to the team were simple: make Marseille do everything. The quote, as remembered by Sinisa Mihailovic, went simply, "When you have the ball, give it back to them." We would perhaps take that to mean park the bus, and while it wasn't quite that, it wasn't that far away. Across 120 minutes, Zvezda didn't force a save, and Marseille only managed 10 shots. While Stojanovic redeemed himself with some saves during regulation time, there was little in the way of good chances, as Petrovic's plan to force Marseille to play against a type of defensive football that was tighter than they came across in most games worked. It meant penalties. Marseille didn't have much of anything in the way of penalty shootout pedigree. Sven and Zvezda were in a league with Scheiber's penalties, where, in addition to extensive penalty practice the day before the game, Zvezda were guaranteed 5 to 6 shootouts under pressure a season to hone their craft. Up first would be Prosinecki, sending the keeper Pascal Omita the wrong way. Then came Amoros for Marseille. His run-up started 10 yards out, and he blasted a low shot to Stojanovic's right at a comfortable height for an easy save. From then on came penalty perfection, until up stepped Darko Panchev for Zvezda's 5th penalty. A goal would win. Olmeta jumped forward so that when Panchev struck, he was about 4 yards off his line, but Panchev blasted his penalty high into the net, not giving Olmeta time to get his hands up to try to block it. Sven and Zvezda were champions of Europe. While it's hard to describe winning a European Cup as a letdown, this is one of the cases where the quality and drama of the semi-final gets obscured by the sheer crapness of the final. In a way, history serves to obscure this side immensely. A poor final, the shadows of war, the changes to the tournament. Even within the same decade, Sven and Zvezda's European Cup win seems like some sort of mad anomaly lost to time that football itself had rectified by moving power and trophies back towards the superclubs. The legacy of this side is almost always written about the history of everything else around it. And that, ultimately, is grossly unfair on what is one of history's greatest club sides. When the magazine 442 listed the top 50 club sides ever in one of their monthly editions earlier this year, the Marseille generation beaten in this final between 88 and 93 came 45th. Milan, 87 to 91, were third. This generation of Sven and Zvezda weren't in it at all. This generation of Stunners Fiesta, who beat that Marseille side, and who that Milan side beat only in extremely controversial circumstances, weren't put in consideration. Perhaps that says more about the authors of that particular list and the author of this particular podcast than it does about this side of Fiestas. This generation of Stunners Fiesta deserves some respect on their name. Victory in Bari was the end of a 12-year run from the 1979 UEFA Cup final that saw Fiesta's eyes fixated on European competition. For the first few years of that, it would be in trying to put together individual talents good enough to do it on their own. Once that experiment broke down in the mid-80s after first round exits to Verona and Benfica, as well as being outclassed by Maradona's Barcelona, they instead began to build a team that could challenge the best, one that was built organically, first around Pixi, then adding Savicevic and Prosnecki, and Panchev and Belotidici, and finally Jukovic and Mihailovic. Arguably, this side needed Pixi to leave to achieve its full potential. His departure allowed Jukovic and Mihailovic to come into the side, gave Prosnecki a freer role, and basically give the midfield a better balance, rather than one where everyone was ultimately always looking towards Pixi. But quite aside from the 12-year journey from Mönchengladbach to Munich, this was the end of a three-season journey of European adventure. Season 1 ended with bad luck thanks to the fog of Belgrade letting Milan off the hook. Season 2 ended with lessons to be learned after the calamity of Köln. And Season 3 ended with what was an inevitable European Cup win. A club that had, from top to bottom, learned the lessons of the previous seasons, from the big calls like backing youth and picking up the exiled Belotidici, to the small ones like how they prepared for that final compared with how they failed to prepare for Köln. And while some may think the manner of their win obscures some of their qualities, the way they got to that final was by playing some of the most exhilarating football you could hope to see. As you'll know, I'm Scottish, and having watched Scottish sides in Europe for the past 25 odd years, I've never seen champions outplayed as utterly comprehensively as Rangers were by Stunners Fiesta. When Walter Smith stated his scouting report as, "We're effed," even he would have been hard pressed to have thought just how effed they were. Fiesta looked against them like they were playing almost a different sport to his club. A fast-paced pressing game that saw perhaps the most divinely talented midfield football has ever put together take advantage of the extra space that was available in that era of football in the most ruthless fashion. When you look at the futures of the players in that midfield, you have perhaps the best season of Prosinecki's life, before injury robbed him of much of his mobility, Savicevic in one of his last seasons before spending years arguing with Capello, Mihailovic before dropping back to a purely defensive role, and Jukovic similarly before position moves and niggling injuries started to impact his game. All four would become some of the world's finest players, but it was only within this Stunners Fiesta midfield that we got their purest incarnations, their best form, their greatest team. Up ahead of them was the golden boot of Darko Panchev and the irresistible pace, even if by his own admission he didn't have that much else, of Turki Sabinic. Behind them was a cultured yet cynical backline. They dominated Yugoslav football as much as any side we've covered in the past, be that Partizan's Babies, be that Hajduk's Golden Team, or be that the Zvezda of Miljanic, and then went and did it in Europe as well. To fail to consider them as one of the 50 best sides in the history of football is pretty much criminal. Had what happened next not happened next, history would have gotten out of the way and shown this genuinely generational side for what it was, and would have permitted them the extra dominance beyond the 3 to 5 year period that it seemed was the maximum that any great Yugoslav side could ever be permitted before imploding one way or another. But implode this great side would, not because of the club's own decisions, but because the nation was about to. Within a month of their win in Bari, the war would begin in earnest, and the history that this side made, their march to the top of the world that places them squarely in the discussion as one of football's greatest ever club sides, suddenly seemed incredibly and depressingly insignificant. Because next time on the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, we go to that point, the final true Yugoslav First League season of 1990-1991. A season with conflict and controversy that would end with clubs and countries leaving us forever. Thank you very much for listening. This, as sort of indicated in the last episode, has sort of turned out to be the longest episode of the timeline yet. It comes in about 300-400 words, the script, longer than the Maximia Riot episode, which was a bit of a behemoth in itself. So thank you very much if you had the patience to listen to this all in one go. I appreciate that as we've gone along, the episode length has duly become a little bit more demanding, because there's more stuff going on and there's more primary sources to keep track of as well, which, you know, is obviously a great help to someone like me putting the history of it all together. So yes, next episode will of course be the final Yugoslav First League season. It will undoubtedly be a bit controversial because there are a lot of controversial things going on in it, particularly because it is sort of history laced in with the football, sandwiching it, as it were, which will make more sense when you sort of see how it goes. I think it's going to be quite a different episode to the ones we've done before, which have generally been quite sticking to a topic, where this one is sticking to a topic but very, very firmly chronologically, rather than this went on and that went on. So yes, do keep an eye out for that. I say I'm sort of about halfway through writing the script as things stand, so it may be a little bit yet because it is looking like it's going to be a very long episode again. So it remains for me just to say, obviously, sharing is caring. Do please share this podcast via your favoured social media sites. More as we get, the better it is. But yeah, thank you very much for listening, and I will catch you next time.